Welcome to the Do Your Good podcast series. In this podcast series, you'll hear from me, Sybil, and other experts in the field to help you make your money matter and make a huge difference in the world. I come to you with over two decades of experience as a person who's helped donors give away over $45 million in donations, both large and small. This podcast series is meant to give you the tools you need to be effective in the world and fund nonprofits and issues that you care about with meaning and purpose, and to make a true, deep difference in the world. Please note that the discussion about suicide prevention is a very sensitive topic. Only listen to this podcast season if you're adequately prepared for the discussion. If you or someone you love is struggling with thoughts of suicide, please seek professional support and call the 988 Lifeline for immediate care and help. Hi, everyone. So in this episode, I'm going to focus in on positive solutions. The question presented, as I told you before, in my previous episodes, and if you haven't listened to those, please listen to them first before you listen to the solutions. Sometimes, if you're like me, I will skip to the end of a book and read the conclusion. But if you do that, you're going to miss a lot, so definitely listen to my first ones first. Anyway, so let's talk about solutions. In this one episode, I'm going to talk about the different avenues that we can pursue, where in my interviews, I saw some really wonderful positive agreement among people from all sides of this debate around firearm-related suicide prevention. And also, how do you potentially increase the uptake of something called an extreme risk protection order? And I'm going to call those ERPOs in this episode. They're otherwise known as red flag laws. And I also discuss them in much more detail in my previous couple of episodes. So please listen to those first. All right. So now we're talking about these solutions. And what I find is that going straight to ERPOs as the solution to reduce suicide by firearm, simply put, it doesn't work if you go straight there. All sides of the debate get polarized. But I am convinced, after talking with lots of folks, that extreme risk protection orders, or ERPOs, do have a role in the conversation. And the thing that's so important, though, is that we put ERPOs in context and within the continuum of supports that someone may need if they're at risk of suicide. There's the immediate support. So if someone is really in that crisis situation right away and they're thinking of moving forward immediately, so heart-wrenching, so hard. The most important thing that researchers have told me is that that person is able to seek help from a loved one or somebody who they can relate to right away. And that that person, the listener, is not judgmental. And there are crisis lines. 988 is the national one. But in my research, I interviewed and found a whole number of interesting crisis lines focused very much on the specific person who'd be calling. And so they can relate to the person on the other end. And the coolest one was a person I talked to. Well, actually, all of them were so great. But there was this one program where they focused in on training kids to talk to kids, youth to talk to youth who are in crisis. And the youth who are the listeners and supporters on the other end of the line to help someone who is going through crisis, they were guided by professional healthcare folks who really knew what was going on. Really interesting program. And I'll have links to that information in the show notes. But there's so many programs like this. And I just love it. So many wonderful things. So that's the first solution, is to make sure that somebody is right there and supporting the person in crisis immediately. And then that person can access the caregiver, care person right away. Now I want you to hear from Brian Pinkerton from the United States Veterans Affairs, and he is based in Klamath Falls and is an expert on supporting veterans who are struggling with suicidal thoughts and helping them get through.
One example that I can think of is a young soldier, an Army officer, who came into my office and just said that he was hurting and that he was pretty much done with all the hurt in his life. And so I just asked him to talk. I thanked him for coming in and talking with me and asked him to tell me what the hurt was, what is hurting you. And I just listened. There is this intense desire in me to help. And so, I love this person. He's a good friend of mine, and I didn't want them to hurt. And there were these desires in me to say, hey, wait, stop. There are people who love you. There are people that are connected, and I know helps and that kind of thing. But I restrained those intentions or those thoughts and just listened and validated his feelings. Something to the effect of, I can understand how that was hurtful, and listened to those feelings and allowed him to process that hurt with me. And at the end, I just thanked him for talking to me and let him know that I was available and encouraged him to seek professional help to get counseling for his hurt. And I think that kind of genuine, non-judgmental listening is probably the most effective methodology for meeting the needs of somebody who's struggling with thoughts of suicide.
That was such a moving story that Brian told me. I really wanted to share that with you. He also is an expert in the different trainings that someone can take to be a support person for a loved one who is having a crisis. We talk about that, and here's some of his suggestions.
There are a lot of trainings. Probably the most well-known and the most researched training is Applied Suicide Intervention Skills Training, ASSIST. It is put on by LivingWorks. It is a 2-day, 16-hour intervention training and is a globally recognized best practice for suicide intervention. But there are other really effective trainings. Veterans Affairs has SAVE training. There is QPR. There are other trainings. All of them have that same understanding that the purpose of intervention is to allow a person to address their feelings of hopelessness and to hear those without judgment, and then to get that person to a next level of help. So there are trainings that you can go to, the QPR, SAVE, the ASSIST, those things, and become informed to know when your family member or the person on the bus with you or that coworker comes to you and says, hey, I'm thinking about killing myself. You know how to respond. You know how to respond effectively. So there is a huge need for the general population to become informed about how to address feelings of suicidality.
Another thing that's important to think about, and that Brian also talked to me about, he's from the VA, as a reminder, based in Klamath Falls, Oregon. He explained that when a person is thinking about suicide, they plan it with a particular means in mind, and they don't usually shift that means. Here's what he has to say about that.
There is a number of things that we can do because there are a number of situations that we have to deal with. Ideally, the best way to prevent that is to remove the accessibility of that method of suicide. Incidentally, people who choose to die by suicide usually choose a method, and whether that method is firearms or taking medication or using ligatures or whatever it may be, that is typically the only method that they use. It sounds counterintuitive. If I can't find this means, then I'll use another means, is what most people think happens, but that is not true. Typically what happens is that a person decides, I will die by this method. And if that method is not available, then it is a kind of like a shock to their system, and they no longer try to pursue that method, and it gives them some more time. So what we have found with firearms is that the way that we can protect those individuals is to provide time and distance to accessibility. So the greatest way that we can provide protection for the individual is to remove that firearm, whether that is being held in a locked facility away from where they live, or being held by a family member, or whatever that is, but to have that weapon removed. That is the ideal way that we can provide that protection. From there, we go to ever-decreasing means of removing it. So what I mean by that is it depends on the individual, whether or not they will allow that firearm to be moved out of their presence. So some people just either will not or cannot do it. For instance, if you have a police officer who uses a firearm on a daily basis, they need to have immediate access to that firearm. So we cannot remove it from their presence. So we have to work with their accessibility to it to meet the needs of their reality. Other people just have, you know, they may feel insecure or feel like they need to have it near, or they live in a household that has firearms that they would have access to, but they can't get rid of. So what we do is we try to provide time and distance. One way of doing that is by locking that device up. First, removing the ammunition from it and storing that in a separate locked space. And then putting that firearm in a locked storage facility. And ideally, we can have that firearm disassembled. So if there is a desire to have access to that firearm, they have to assemble it. They have to first unlock it. They have to assemble it. Then they have to go to another locked device and unlock it for ammunition and load it. And then that's a lot of time and a lot of potential for thinking. So that is another method. If that person can't or won't do that, then we can have a locked device for that weapon, ideally in a storage facility, you know, a safe or a lockbox. If that's not an option, then we can use a locking device like a cable lock or a trigger lock. All of those, ideally, we would have ammunition away from that. Again, there may be a situation where that is not possible, so we can do things like remove the firing pin or disassemble it some other way like that. And we deal with each case below those levels of safety as are necessary.
Okay, so you just listened to Brian talking about removing the firearm from the person who is at risk of suicide. And I do want to note something very important. I asked Brian if he regularly uses extreme risk protection orders in his work. And my understanding from our conversation is that he does not. So while you're hearing him list sort of options there to remove the firearm in order to save a life, I also purposely put the other conversation I had with him about love and respect for the person who's undergoing a serious crisis and to not show judgment. And so the important thing is that Brian is talking about removing the means of suicide that someone is thinking about, but he doesn't use ERPOs regularly, and he also is making sure that he only removes the firearm from the presence of the person if it's something that works for that person. I also wanted to note that he talks a lot about secure storage so that the person can have time and distance to think through their crisis. And one thing he talks a lot about, Brian does, is how quickly someone acts once they think of actually doing suicide and taking act of taking their own life. It can happen really quickly. And so if you're allowing someone some space and time to think and then reach out, that's really critical. So I wanted to underline that. I know we've talked about that before. Let's talk a little bit more now with some of the folks that I interviewed about the idea of secure storage and locking the firearm up so that it does give somebody time and distance. In addition, it can help if a child or someone who's a youth, younger person who may not already have access to their own firearm, but if a firearm is around the home, then they could have access to it that way unless it's locked up. And so let's talk about some of these pieces, because one thing I did see is some wonderful alignment from folks on all sides of the political spectrum around secure storage. There were some concerns. For example, the folks who own firearms, they say, you know, we know best about how to keep our firearms secure, and we don't want to always have to remove the ammunition from our firearm, especially if we need it for self-defense. So I'll get into that a little bit here with some of the interviews I did as well. And as a note, we do have a law in Oregon that requires secure storage of a firearm, but it does not require someone to remove the ammunition from that firearm for some of these reasons, from some of the reasons that I discuss here with my folks that I talk to. All right, I'm going to give you some interview quotes now because I found the discussion really interesting around all this. Let's first hear from Donna Marie Drucker from the Oregon Firearm Safety Coalition on this matter.
So in Oregon, when we look at our firearm deaths, there's we've had an increase in ER visits due to accidents, and you can't see me making air quotes, but I'm going to call it negligence, because if you follow the golden firearm safety rules, you cannot have an accident. So yes, there are people that do enter the ER, and since 2020, there was an increase with that. But the majority of firearm deaths, sadly, are suicide. We only have 1 to 2 deaths a year due to negligence or accidents. And that is because firearm owners are safe. The majority of firearm owners take safety incredibly seriously. And it is drilled into the kids. It's drilled in everywhere you go. There are no accidents at gun ranges or at gun clubs, because safety is the number one. Even if I'm cleaning my firearm and I've disassembled it, I am never pointing a single piece at anything I'm not willing to destroy, including my foot, right? Even if it's in pieces, because to me, that firearm is always loaded. Gun owners are safe. We don't have a lot of accidents. We certainly don't have a lot of accidental deaths. So if you approach a gun owner about safety, they're going to tune you out because they're safe. They don't need to hear about safety. They've heard about safety probably from the day that they were born. New gun owners are taking trainings. They're hearing about safety all the time. And if I say to somebody that has a firearm for self-defense, is your firearm safe? Their idea of safety could be round in a chamber next to the bedside table. I'm ready to go. I'm safe. I'm ready to protect my family at a second's notice. So safe and secure don't mean the same thing. For me, I want that firearm. I want that person to feel safe, but I want it in a quick action release secure storage device. So they can still have a round in the chamber. They can still have that firearm in their hands in less than 2 seconds, ready to go for that self-defense moment. But there's zero unauthorized access. That means no kids in the home can get a hold of it. Nobody that's having a hard time can get a hold of it. It cannot be stolen and used in crimes. So secure means zero unauthorized access to persons other than that firearm owner. Safe can mean it's in the bedside table drawer. And people don't engage in conversations around safety. We want people to engage in conversations around secure storage. Not only that, we have a new secure storage law that means that firearms need to be securely stored all the time. And we want to engage people in that law. And again, talking about safety in laws, people don't want to engage in laws that don't, that go against what they feel is safe. If we change that language and talk about secure storage laws and how can we keep you safe within the law, that's an entirely different conversation.
I also asked Donna Marie if she could give me some examples of positive stories where her organization or others offered lockboxes to firearm owners, because one of the issues is the cost. And so, like, how do we navigate that? So I talked to her about that, and I thought that her answers were really interesting and intriguing, so I shared them here.
So, and again, I want to say that a lot of folks in Oregon have been doing amazing work providing folks with secure storage. So one of the programs that we were first involved with was with the Association of Oregon Mental Health Care Providers. They had received funding from the Oregon Health Authority, and nearly every county has a suicide prevention coordinator. And through those grants, they provided every suicide prevention coordinator with secure storage devices to be handed out through their mobile crisis units, at their walk-in clinics, like anywhere that they thought was a good place to be handing them out. And we specifically worked with Clackamas County to help develop language around what, because they wanted to put stickers on things, so it's not just a device. They wanted to make sure that people understood that this was a positive thing. And I think I have our example over here. So you can see this. This was the sticker that started to hand out. Secured firearms save lives. Putting time and distance between a person in crisis and a firearm can prevent death by suicide. And then the Clackamas County lines and the national lines. So this was a really good way to get the right language out with a secure storage device and to make it very gun positive. In a sense, like there was, you know, just this is what people should be doing. And I think Clackamas County, they had a really successful rollout. I think they've handed out like over 2,000 secure storage devices. We helped them sort of find the right kind of secure storage devices to be handing out. We connected them with manufacturers so that you can work directly with the manufacturer instead of sort of having to go through a sporting goods store. And that was really really helpful for us to sort of understand how this was working out for folks. They actually launched a website where you can just go there and order secure storage devices. And that was another sort of way that we could see how much gun owners wanted these devices, that people were really engaging with Clackamas County and really sort of excited to be getting good quality secure storage devices for their long guns and for their handguns. And then when we started to talk about all firearms, it was like, well, what about secure storage for that self-defense firearm? And they engaged with Voltec, which is an amazing manufacturer for quick action sort of secure storage devices. And they even, you know, if somebody's like, I will secure everything apart from my self-defense firearm, they will provide them with this really top of the line, high quality, secure storage that provides for immediate access so that even that self-defense firearm can be secured. We were recently able to receive funding from the Oregon Health Authority to provide secure storage devices, again, Voltec, LifePod, secure storage devices for two events, Portland Pride and Eugene Pride. The Oregon Department of Veteran Affairs has a veteran village that is run by Ian Michael, and we were invited to participate in the veteran village. And through our partnerships with the Oregon Health Authority, we were able to purchase like 70 secure storage devices, which again, really top of the line. And we were able to engage with our veteran community, which are at significant higher risk of suicide than folks that have not served. Our LGBTQIA2S plus community, which again, significantly higher risk. And female veterans female veterans have had a significant increase in death by suicide. So at this event, we were handing out these devices to folks that met multiple criteria. I would say 100% were service member connected in some capacity, either by being a veteran or an active duty service member or a family member of somebody that had served. 50% were women. 50% of folks had children in the home. I would say about 60% were part of the LGBTQIA2S plus community. So, I mean, it was a really powerful moment to be handing out these devices to folks. And the comments that we got back were, first of all, why is it free? Like, this is such an amazing device. How is it that you're giving it to us for free? So it was a real privilege to say, your state provides us with money so that we can provide you with this. I had tears. I had hugs. I can't believe you're giving this to me. I looked at this, but I couldn't afford it. Oh my God, this is like amazing. People were so grateful. They were grateful to be seen and to be respected as gun owners. They were grateful to be supported as veterans and just a part of all the different communities that they intersected with, and to be able to provide them with storage that I felt very confident would be used and would be used to secure that self-defense firearm was huge. And you could just see how people went from like, this is just support and this is just love. There's no negativity here. And with that, we provided folks with training information where they could connect with the Liberal Gun Club, the Pink Pistols. And you could just see that people felt like they were part of a community that was supporting them in a very meaningful and then tangible way. That was like a real win to sort of be bringing everybody together, the ODVA, the Oregon Health Authority, the Oregon Firearm Safety Coalition, and I'm also part of Together with Veterans Northwest Oregon, to see that collaboration in action. Again, something that we wouldn't have seen 3 or 4 years ago.
I hope you are inspired by Donna Marie's stories. I certainly was. And now let's hear a little bit more about this issue from Jess Marks from the Oregon Alliance for Gun Safety. I thought she had really valuable things to say as well.
You know, the biggest thing that I think we could do right now that would just make such a huge impact is trying to figure out how to sustainably fund secure storage devices. We talk about this and we've heard this conversation for so long. And, you know, there's sometimes disagreement about what does secure storage really mean and whether or not, you know, having a weapon or a firearm next to your bed, et cetera. And at the end of the day, what we have found is when secure storage, in particular, I'm talking about lockboxes and safes, which are not cheap. You know, they're $50 minimum to can go way up. But when they're distributed, we see big increases in usage, including for that self-defense weapon that, you know, you can have a lockbox by your bed that, you know, I talked to my cousin and his wife, and at first they were kind of hesitant. And now they say, you know, I can access it in the same amount of time I could before when I was in a drawer. And they have two little kids and they're glad that it's, you know, secure and their kids can't access it. And so if we could really figure out a model to fund and distribute secure storage devices, so if it's someone who participates in a community foundation locally, you know, leading your community foundation, and, you know, from my view, longer term, it's a policy change that the state needs to support.
And Jess goes on to talk about some more specific pieces around secure storage that I think you'll find interesting. Have a listen.
There's more and more evidence that states that do have secure and basically they're often called child access laws have much lower rates of suicide, youth suicide, et cetera. And the same thing is true with transportation and how you're transporting a firearm in a vehicle, because there's a big issue all across the country of firearms being stolen from vehicles. So our law in Oregon, you know, is really intended at making sure that someone who should not have access to your firearm, does not have access. And the key piece around it is that you can actually be held liable if someone accesses it who's not supposed to. Something I think is really important to note is if a firearm is stolen from you and you report it, you know, within, I think it's 48 hours, you're not liable. So it's a really actually, I think, a well done law in that, you know, it's really encouraging making sure only the authorized person has access to the firearm. With that said, a lot of people don't even know that law exists, and people own firearms for different reasons. And so, you know, really going back to that conversation of we need to really be working with firearm owners to understand what kind of tools, you know, is it a safe, et cetera, that will support them in storing their firearm in a way that is secure and making sure people don't have access, but also feels realistic. The law in Oregon, you actually are allowed to have your ammo stored with your firearm. It just needs to make sure that there is no unauthorized access. And so having, you know, a gun safe, whether it's a biometric safe by your bed, whether it's all of your, actually most hunters I know already, they do store ammo and firearms separately, but that's can be a different context if you have a, you know, hunting rifle versus if you have a handgun by your bed, where a lot of folks do have their ammo stored with their firearm. And that is the law in Oregon, but you know, we want to just make sure that it's then in a safe and stored where nobody can access it except the person who is intended to.
Okay, so now you've heard about some really interesting, in my opinion, interesting solutions that some of the folks I talked with offered. Let's also now circle back to the question of extreme risk protection orders and how they fit into the conversation. I want to bring up a conversation I had with Jake Chandler, who was a police officer in Bend and used extreme risk protection orders quite effectively to his advantage to support people who are at risk of suicide. And I found his stories very, very promising in terms of a creative solution to be able to utilize ERPOs effectively as well. And importantly, his project and his work when he was a police officer in Bend is he partnered with a mental health expert who rode around with him in his police car to support his work. So let's have a listen to some of his experiences trying to use extreme risk protection orders to support people who are at risk of suicide. Have a listen.
Yeah, I mean, it's really hard to tell exactly how many lives are saved with extreme risk protection orders. In my opinion, every time that I file for an extreme risk protection order, in my mind, based on what was presented to me, I'm saving a life, either someone directly from killing themselves or from them killing somebody else. And so there's no data to back that up. I don't know exactly what the numbers are. I have had people after the fact, when an ERPO was filed or after it expired, who had told me, you know, I didn't agree with it at the time, but not having access to weapons during this time, it did save my life. And so it's hard to tell what the numbers are. In my mind, I'd like to say it was 100% of the time. I know that's not realistic, but there are times where people reach out afterwards. And I do believe that if we did not have that contact with that person at that time, there's a high likelihood that they would kill themselves or someone else.
And I asked Jake why he thinks that extreme risk protection orders are underutilized.
Yeah, I think that they're still underutilized in probably every county. And in my opinion, the biggest reason for that is the fear of something new and not knowing what it's like. ERPOs are often equated to similar as a search warrant for officers, which are very intimidating. I know that they are for me. And so my suggestion is for any officer to has questions for it is find someone that's done one before, have them work through the ERPO with you, or call me and I'll work through it with you also, and just get one under your belt. Once you finish an ERPO successfully, you realize that it's not like a search warrant. It's just equated similar to it, and it's not as intimidating, and it really is something that will save lives. Well, I've looked at some of the studies as far as why ERPOs are being declined by family members, and some of them are because they don't qualify. Some of them are because the paperwork's not filled out completely. You know, and these ERPOs, especially being as new as they have to be filled out completely accurate and they can't have anything missing. And sometimes it's hard for a loved one to be able to articulate exactly what that threat is and putting that on paper. And so having a police officer come out and do it as a, you know, a non-emotional third party really takes that part of it out of play. And then also the paperwork, the officers know how to do this. So it's nothing new as far as filling in every box, you know, making sure things are signed in the right spots, testifying in front of a judge, which is very intimidating for a lot of people. It's intimidating for police officers. It's intimidating for everybody. And so having an officer that knows how to do that and work through that process is really helpful. I always tell the officers when I'm training to always offer to complete the ERPO for the family member. The other part to that is not just the paperwork. It's also when a family member is filing an ERPO on somebody and it is successful, they're going back home to that person and they're going to continue trying to provide love and care to that person to help them get through this time. And there could be some tension there, some resentment. And so taking them out of play and having the officer or the agency that the officer works for filing the ERPO on the person, it takes that away from it. And so it takes a lot of that pressure and that stress off the family members. And so they can focus on helping their loved one get through this difficult time. The officer can focus on the paperwork and taking the guns and storing the guns and all the other things that are associated with it.
And really, from my conversations with people like Jake, it made me not want to dismiss extreme risk protection orders altogether. It does feel like there's a key role for red flag laws in the role of specifically supporting people who are at risk of suicide. It's just that it's part of a bigger, complex series of activities to support as well. If your true aim is to reduce the risk of suicide by firearm. And the next episode of this season is going to focus on the actual recommendations that I made in the report for the Roundhouse Foundation. So please listen to the next one as well, because that'll bring it all together. In addition to interviewing and talking to the people that you heard from in this podcast season, I interviewed over 28 people, plus some anonymous individuals, for the report. And I also reviewed over 100 documents. And I just found this journey so interesting and important, an important story to tell. And so I do hope you tune into the next episode as well. And thanks so much for listening. So there you have it. I hope you enjoyed this podcast as much as I enjoyed making it for you. So if you want to find out more about what I have to offer, please check out www.doyourgood.com and learn more ways to make your money matter. Until next time, do your good and be well.